succession of 1, 2, 3, 8, 5, rule 3.
Yes.
Yeah, you were just saying about
some of the books
that you'd read.
Oh yes, the different books. Zolar, and I mentioned Barbusse, and many other French writers I can't, but above all, the great American writers, Upland Sinclair's, I read most of his books, his book Oil, and his one about the packing industry, and that's inconceivable that I could forget the name of that, but it's a very famous book by Upton Sinclair that had a great effect on me, of the way the immigrants were exploited in the United States, different waves of immigrants. First of all, the Germans, not for long, and then the Poles, and then the Yugoslavs, and so on there. So that all these books had a great, it was just building up, and it was at this time that I joined the Communist Party of the United States. I can't remember where, but this must have been in the early 20s, I suppose, that...
Where was that? Where did you join?
I can't recollect. Probably San Francisco, I would think. That and then this was after innumerable other... after travelling all over there and being down into Mexico and then... again, I mentioned earlier about my love for steam locomotives, but also I had a great love for some reason of windjammers. I don't know where I got that. I think probably I'd read Dana's 2 Years Before the Mast. I think that was the thing. And I'd read about the great exploits of the American clipper ships of there, about the Lightning and all the other ones, and that great American shipwright who built the finest windjammers in the world. It was just on the tip of my tongue, his name now I've forgotten it. Actually, he was born in Nova Scotia, and his first ships were built in Canada. But later on, he moved to the United States and built the great ships, many of them flying the British flag, the James Baines, and so on, but all built in New England, I think. So I had this love of the sea. And long before I'd ever gotten to see the sea in British Columbia, I had a feeling that the sea is like the wheat fields in the spring, where you had the wind blowing the wheat fields, and you see the whole undulating masses of the wheat waving in the wind, and flat as far as the eye could see, that and these great cumulus clouds there scudding across. And I remember from my childhood of these clouds scudding across these wheat fields, the green wheat and so on, just bursting into yellow. And it seemed to me just that is what the ocean is like, so that I had a feeling for this. And then when I got down to Portland, before I got to Portland, I was hanging about the docks in San Francisco, and also in Seattle, because I thought, well, there were several old windjammers laid up there. Every year they used to go to Alaska for the meat packing, for the fish packing factories. Again, it was on the tip of my tongue. I've forgotten the Alaska's Packers fleet, they called it, the Alaska Packers. And they had these old windjammers that had been in the wool trade to Australia, and but I'd hung about for a long, long time, and I was getting short of money from the last job I had in a lumber camp, and so I decided that it didn't seem to be moving there. I thought I had a good chance of getting a job on one of these ships, because the Americans, no sane American would want to sail on one of these ships. They were sort of hell ships. They consider them hard. They wouldn't even sail on the small American merchant navy at that time. They were mostly Swedes and Norwegians, English or Irish, and so on. That the Americans at that time, although it changed later on, they didn't want to leave their families and so on. So I thought, especially on a windjammer, they were mostly they were either Greeks more likely Portuguese working on these ships. So I just didn't seem to be any sign of movement. They just had watchmen on board the ships, and they were waiting. They said they might or might not sail. So I made my way to down to Portland, Oregon, and there I saw this. It wasn't a square rigger. It was a six-masted schooner, a very large ship loading with timber for Australia. And one of the crew had fallen down the hole or something and broken his leg or something like that. I came just at an opportune moment and said, could I sign on? He was a bit dubious at first. The skipper said, have you any experience? And I said, oh, yes, I've been on the Great Lakes, which he didn't seem to impress him very much on the lake boats. But I got the job, and I was still supposed to be 2 or 3 years older than I really was.
So how old were you really then?
I suppose then I was about 16 or 17, I suppose there, so that, but I said I was probably 20 or something, that I remember they'd try all sorts of jokes on you. There were some Americans on the ship, but a lot of them were Portuguese or Swedes or Norwegians, and because I was a new boy, and although I tried to look older, I remember one time they suggested, although I was young, I wasn't so dumb. So they said, "Oh boy, there! I think a bunch of them were. Would you get a sky hook for me?" So I said, "A sky hook." And he says, yes, you'll find it up forward someplace. So that I gathered that by these small smothered laughs and so on, that, a sky hook is something that comes down from the sky. So that I just went into the sail locker and curled up and went to sleep, and came back about halfway through the watch. Maybe they found me in the sail locker, and thought, what in the hell are you doing here? And I said I was looking, I got so tired looking for this skyhook, I took a rest, so they didn't try any more funny stuff on that. And anyway, we we landed in Sydney after calling in at Hawaii.
Could you tell me a bit about what life was like on this Windjammer, on this ship?
Oh, yes. The conditions were, because it was an American registered ship, the conditions were better than on many other ships, but it had electricity driven from a dynamo, for instance, very, very weak and flickering electricity, and work you were chipping and painting all the time. The work up aloft was sort of not like on a square rigger, because mostly the sails were operated from the deck level with winches and so on. It's much easier, but occasionally you had to go up to the topmast, and that's one thing with my experience of as a high climber in the lumber camps, I was quite used to, so that didn't worry me any. And I was agile as a cat then, I'd move around, and the food was passable, I suppose. A lot of canned stuff, canned beef, and so on. I can't recollect whether we had salt pork or something, but we may have done, but I can't recall.
What was the ship carrying?
Timber. She had all this timber in the hold, and also a great deal of timber on deck too. Timber from Oregon for Australia.
And who was in command of the ship?
Pardon?
Who was in command of the ship?
It was an American in command of the ship. Yes. I've got a feeling, I can't remember his name now, I've got a feeling he was probably a Swedish-American, that he wasn't very old. Well, when you're that age, everyone looks, I suppose he was about 50 or something, but to me he looked fairly old. But the work was hard, but... as far as I remember, we had three watches then, 4 hours on, 8 hours off, that was fairly good. Most of the time you were chipping and painting, you were chipping off the rusted ironwork around the bulwarks and painting it with red lead. I think now probably that's probably a very dangerous occupation I don't know. But and then afterwards, after the red lead was painted on, you'd paint over it with ordinary paint and sail making, sewing the sails and so on. Although it came, the sails came ready-made, repairs and so on had to be done. And changing the sails, when we left Portland, we'd have sort of heavy canvas, but as you got down nearer, in the warmer latitudes, you change those for lighter, well-worn sails and so on, because the other canvas is dear. We lived in the forecastle up forward, some in the deckhouse. I was in the deckhouse on deck, and the captain and the rest of the officers and the donkey man and the Chippy the carpenter and so on, they were in a separate, a smaller forecastle, and the officers, the mates and the captain had quite a nice saloon aft. I can't recollect how long it took us. I know we called in at Hawaii. We got in a call there for water. We went ashore in Hawaii for a while. I suppose we were there for about a week or...
How were you treated by the officers?
Oh, fairly well, you know, that, of course I was, I always pull my weight, they treated me, okay. They said I never had any trouble, with them. Weren't like the, hard-driving Yankee skippers of the Clipper days, no, nothing like that. You couldn't do any sort of, I think it would be very unwise to talk about organizing in a union or something like that, that they take quite a different attitude. So I had enough sense to keep quiet then. That,
what were the other men like on the ship?
Oh, they were generally older in their... late 20s, I suppose, and 30s. They were quite a biggish crew for a ship of that size, but still only about 20, I suppose. That three watches. I think there were about seven in a watch or something. So there's about that and. They treated me, after this first joking, about and trying to put things over on you, and then they saw I wasn't having any of it, then they treated you fairly well. I was the youngest, of course, on the ship, but there were a couple of, guys a few years older than me that, I can't recollect whether they're Americans or Swedes or something, but a great many of them were, several of them were Swedes or Norwegians and so on there. Then when we got to Sydney, I paid off there.
So what did you do when you got to Sydney?
When I got to Sydney, looked around. I hadn't got a great, of course, but we were paying the normal seamen's wages on the ships. I had a bit of money, and I looked around for a while, and then I couldn't see anything much to do there, but. I have a feeling, I'm not certain whether it was before I went up country or whether it was after I went up country that I came back again, but I think it was before this that that I got a job on a building. They were erecting what they called a skyscraper in Sydney at that time, all of about... I think it was 13 or 14 stories high. It was going to be the biggest, highest building in Sydney. But now you see pictures of them 50 stories high or more. But I got a job as a riveter on these buildings. Again, I was used to heights. It didn't worry me any. Although I was... never took any chances that some of the other guys used to walk along these girders with a drop of about 150 feet below you. But I never did. As long as I had anything to hold on to, I was take my chances. But if there wasn't anything to hang on to, I'd just sit astride the girder and inch along there. They said, well, if you can do that 2 feet above the ground, you can do it 200 feet above the ground. But, of course, if you fall off at 2 feet, it doesn't matter. And there were accidents there, of course, so that... But at this time, an event took place. Again, I don't know whether it was then or a little bit later, but someone... and at this time, I'd palled up with some... again, I always seem to meet up with foreign people. I met a most interesting fellow, a communist from... Bremerhaven, his other fellow communists, other Germans, used to kid him about it because his name was, I remember to this day, Erich von Mori, and von is a title. And they said, well, what do you want to keep this von in your name for? Why not just Erich Mori? And he said, no, well, you know, you're a communist. Why do you do that? But that's one thing he hung on to all the time. We were there for all the time. I was in Australia there. There was also Waldemar Bauer. It's funny how I can't remember any of the names of these novels, but I remember Erich von Mori and Waldemar Bauer, who came from Hamburg. There was the big Swede that I've forgotten his name, a whole bunch of us. Then they said, there's a wonderful revolutionary film going to be shown on some Sunday morning that in Woolloomooloo. I remember that name too. That's down just beyond the Domain in Sydney Harbour, a poor part of Sydney at that time. Although I believe now it's quite an art centre, but at that time it was a sort of part with warehouses and so on. And they said, well, they're going to show this wonderful film. It is something that... I was also interested a bit in movies at that day. So they said, issued us... it was some clandestine thing happening. Everything was hush hush. You had this ticket they'd stamp, and you show this at the door, and then you went to this warehouse on this Sunday morning, and then you climbed up some stairs to the upper floor of the warehouse, and there were just benches along there, and they had a movie projector at the back there. They said, this is by that great Russian director, Eisenstein. It's really something, they said, the Battleship Potemkin. And I sort of vaguely heard about this before, but... anyway, the reason why it was so, because it was smuggled into Australia, and I think communism wasn't actually outlawed, but if you were found to be a communist, you were put in the slammer, I think, we went there. And this had a wonderful effect on me, that not only the wonderful scene of the Cossacks marching down the steps, have you seen, and shooting there, but Wolfram had a great effect with the visual effects in the harbour of the ships, with the sun breaking through the mist. And I'd never seen photography like that before. And I thought, well, that's the, they, you know, I'd like to be a photographer, so that, and then they showed this movie there with, I think they had a record player going, but they had no amplification or anything. But anyway, it had such an effect on me that that remained with me to this day.
What other impressions did you get from the film?
Oh, well, it just... this feeling of a great compassion for the people there, that a feeling of these ordinary people, even the members of the bourgeoisie, were so taken up by the 1905 revolution that they were all there, the lady with the pince-nez glasses, and the wonderful scenes of the fighting on the deck, and the fact, the sight of this little doctor with his pince-nez, that reminds me, where they said, "We can't eat the meat, it's rotten." It was crawling with lice, and you see him take off his pince-nez and bring it up and down close to his eyes, and you see the lice multiply, and then he says, "Oh no, that's nothing, you can just wash it off with a little vinegar or something." And then when the sight of the sailors, all this built up in my mind, I had already had a feeling that the Russians were the cream of the working class of the world. They were the vanguard of the workers. They'd storm the Winter Palace, and this just added to my feeling that. And then, with the when they threw the tarpaulin over the people that refused to eat the meat, and were going, and then the fellow says, "Friends, comrades, you know, don't shoot down your brothers," or words to that effect. And the fact that it sort of flashed across the scene, I think it was even more effective than if it had been a talking movie. So that this all had a wonderful, invigorating effect on...
How did the rest of the audience react to the film, do you think?
I think to the same way, because they weren't all communists there. By I suppose there were about, maybe, hard to say, 50 or 100 people there. Just the place seemed crowded to me, but I couldn't actually think exactly how many. I didn't count them, but between 50 and 100, I would say it would seem quite crowded, and everyone was sort of rooted to their chairs, and there were a sort of cross-section. There were longshoremen and workers and obviously business people, women and men, well-dressed and so on. So obviously from the middle classes, and everyone after the to come to the and then the scene of as I said, probably that didn't affect them, the scenes of the sun shining through. Probably they liked it, but the other ones of the whole mass of people coming down to pay their respects to the murdered person on the quayside, and them putting money in. And also I remember very, very upper class types, landowners or something, saying, "Oh, something about they're just Jews," or something, "Oh, that's just a Jew," or something, and then the whole of the sort of crowd turned on these two landowning types or bosses of a factory or something, and they didn't beat them up, but they sort of pulled their hats down over their head and disappeared. Even the sort of middle class in the film I'm talking about, and that was so probably how the people, the middle class people, reacted to the thing, especially with regard to Jews, you see, that then when it came, the other things, the sign where the ships all came out, showing the solidarity of the workers, that had a great effect on me, of taking all their food, the animals for the people on the ship, and the fruit, and going out in these hundreds of little ships sailing out to this the battleship, and then also the fact after the shooting on the steps there where the guns being trained on the headquarters of the army and firing, and then of course then just the whole of the people were then you saw the ship preparing to leave, and the whole of the people and sort of just laying about after the struggle, of course, and then they were going out to sea, and you found the often I found later in Spain that same sort of